Thank you so much. It's a very clear and complete introduction. I think we can go on and pass to the first section. So I would like to call the speakers and the chair of the first section, Krista, who is going to chair this first part of the conference, which is devoted, as was already mentioned, to jurisdictional aspects. Where we have two very well-reputed experts for that. Yeah.
Can I push that back a little bit? Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, Krista will say some words.
I think Krista will introduce
Good morning, everybody. It's my great pleasure to welcome you as well in the name of the Institute. And we're starting out in the first full session with looking at a topic that, as a law student in the U.S., I found extremely complicated. But it was probably also because it was the very first morning of my very first day of law school, and we had civil procedure law. And, you know, you're supposed to have read these cases, and I had no idea what it was about. So I'm actually really looking forward to relearning things that I actually probably should have learned and never quite understood. And we have two excellent speakers for you today. The first speaker is Professor Linda Silberman from the New York University School of Law, whose the biographies are in your book, but there are a couple of things I think also deserve mentioning. Besides being a professor of law, she is extremely active as well in developing the law through the American Law Institute, in which she's worked as an advisor on three different projects that I think bear mentioning: the Restatement Third of the U.S. Law on International Commercial Arbitration, the Restatement Fourth of the Foreign Relations Law of the United States, and also the Restatement Third of Conflicts of Laws. And so obviously she's well-versed in all of the topics that we're going to be talking about, and we're very much looking forward to her discussion of general jurisdiction, I believe all-purpose jurisdiction, and we will then follow that on with a more detailed look at specific jurisdiction. So Professor Silberman, please.
Thank you very much. Thank you to Andrea and to the Institute for having me, for putting together this wonderful conference. I just have to say, Andrea spent a month with us at NYU last year, and he attended my international litigation and arbitration class every time, and he was actually a sort of wonderful addition to that class. And so we actually had a comparative class as a result. And so I'm thrilled to sort of be here and to share my views with you, because I learned so much from having him in my class, and now to have a whole group of you to have this exchange is really a thrill. So thank you very much. I just want one sort of clarification of this. This is about judicial jurisdiction, because people tend to use the term jurisdiction sometimes to talk about the reach of law, and that's going to be this afternoon with Bill Dodge. Both Sam and I are talking about the exposure of a defendant, indeed a foreign defendant in these cases, to the courts of the United States as a matter of judicial jurisdiction. Now, in 2015, I published a number of articles, one of them in the yearbook, about the Supreme Court's decision in the Daimler or the Daimler case, depending, and the end of what we call the doing business jurisdiction in the United States. And I don't want to rehash all of that, but I would rather turn to the last part of the title that I was given, which is what next? But let me just provide a short summary of Daimler to put this in context. As I think most of you are aware, the outer limit on the assertion of jurisdiction in the United States is a constitutional one, and it's limited by the Due Process Clause of the Constitution. And prior to Daimler, with maybe a hint of a change coming in the earlier 2011 Goodyear case. A corporation that had continuous and systematic activities in a state was subject to what we call general or all-purpose jurisdiction, meaning that you could be sued on any claim, whether related or not to the defendant's forum activities. So in Daimler, which was a case involving a claim brought by foreign plaintiffs against a foreign defendant for events that occurred outside the United States, the Supreme Court, in an opinion by Justice Ginsburg, made clear that for a corporate defendant, it was about corporate defendants, to be subject to general jurisdiction, it must be essentially at home there. And the paradigm situation of at home was to be understood as the corporation's place of incorporation or its principal place of business. Now, there was a footnote, and the court conceded that in an exceptional case, a corporation's operations in a state other than the formal place of incorporation or principal place of business might be sort of so substantial to make it at home. But certainly, that was not the situation in Daimler, and I can tell you that there has been no case, very, very early, just wrongly decided case, but no case when it's thought about that has managed to meet that exception standard. Now, I think this at-home rule would seem uncontroversial to many of you, but it represented a dramatic sea change for jurisdictional jurisprudence in the United States. And although Justice Ginsburg said, well, special jurisdiction, specific jurisdiction, as we call it, would fill the gap in terms of jurisdictional reach, it turns out that our rules of specific jurisdiction are much more limited than in the rest of the world. So the U.S. constitutional standard does not just require a connection between the litigation and the forum, but also a forum connection with the particular defendant. Now, Justice Sotomayor wrote a concurring opinion, which she thought the jurisdiction over Daimler in this case would violate due process, but she would have retained this doing business, systematic and continuous line of activities, and she said, but we can use this standard of unreasonableness to limit jurisdiction. But she was, of course, only a concurrence, and nobody has followed it. And more interestingly, I think, and it's something we always quote, she criticized the court for overturning a rule about general jurisdiction, which she said had been taught to generations of first-year law students. So if there are any of you who were trained in the United States before 2014, your knowledge is out of date. And I must say that I have a student who's studying for the New York Bar, and he came into my office and he said, Professor Silberman, I don't know what to do. The bar says that there's general jurisdiction for continuous and systematic activities, and I know that's wrong. I know that's Daimler, but do you think the bar examiners know that it's wrong? So, but both of the cases that I mentioned involve jurisdiction over foreign country defendants, the Supreme Court just in May applied this at-home standard to a domestic defendant. The state judge said, oh, well, this is about foreign defendants, not domestic defendants. But it, of course, applies to both. And the court there actually talked about the exceptional possibility and said, remember, if we're talking about any kind of exception, we're talking about comparison. It's got to be compared to worldwide or, in that case, nationwide activities. But note, when the Daimler standard is applied to a domestic defendant, there's always still some state in the United States where you can be subject to suit. So the kinds of things that Andrea mentioned, all of these details about American, and Tom mentioned about pleading rules and discovery rules are still going to apply. With respect to a foreign defendant, the jurisdictional consequences are much more significant because a plaintiff will have no U.S. forum with all of the attendant procedures in which to bring suit. And even when a foreign corporation causes injury in a state in the United States, if it doesn't have its place of incorporation or principal place of business, it's not going to be subject to general jurisdiction anywhere. And there will be no what we call specific jurisdiction unless the foreign defendant has conducted purposeful activity in that particular state, since it's the connection with the relevant state and not the United States. It's critical, and I'm not going to step on Professor Baumgartner, who's going to talk to you much more about that. So what about the possibilities of mitigating Daimler? Well, first of all, there's been these consent by registration. So the impact of the Daimler rule can be mitigated to the extent that a defendant can consent to general jurisdiction. And after Daimler, some courts have found such implied consent when a corporation has appointed an in-state agent for service of process, as is often required by state statutes if you want to do business in that state. Now, in some states, and this is in a state of flux at the moment, the consequences of appointing an agent is only to allow service. In others, they say, no, this will permit special or specific jurisdiction. And other states, like New York, have actually construed their statute to be consent to general jurisdiction. Now, a number of courts have said, no, Daimler has prevented this, and to do this would be to allow Daimler in the back door. So at the moment, there are conflicting decisions in the federal and state courts, and eventually the Supreme Court is going to have to answer that. Now, I'm not sure whether foreign country corporations appoint agents in order to do business, but I think the more relevant statute for this audience are the ones that require foreign banks to register and appoint an agent in order to carry on banking in a U.S. state, where failure to do so can result in fines and forfeitures. And so a number of states, including Illinois, New York, California, have these statutes. And in particular, the New York banking law requires foreign banks operating in New York to have a registered agent. But that statute expressly limits jurisdiction to proceedings against it that arise out of a transaction with a New York agency or branch. And so, in fact, the New York foreign banking registration statute can only be used to assert specific jurisdiction, that is, related claims, although there are a couple of courts that have rendered decisions that seem to have taken a different view. I mean, I think they're wrong, but I just sort of emphasize that. Now, how about specific jurisdiction as a gap filler? So given what I've said, you might be relaxing and saying, with respect to foreign banks, they should be able to avoid U.S. jurisdiction for claims that are unrelated to their U.S. banking activity. That is the banking registration statute and the Daimler case. However, several cases, both before and after Daimler, appear to have adopted a liberal interpretation of this specific jurisdiction, or what is related to the activities of the bank. And so the leading case, as some of you may know, is the Leachy versus Lebanese Canadian bank case, which held that the Lebanese Canadian bank's repeated use of a correspondent bank account with American Express in New York on behalf of its client satisfied the lesser standard of transaction of business. When you see the term transaction of business, courts use that as the basis for specific jurisdiction, that is, for related claims. So in Leachy, which involved claims brought by U.S., Canadian, and Israeli citizens that were killed or injured by Hezbollah rockets in Israel, they brought that suit against the bank for allegedly aiding and abetting the terrorist activities. And the New York Court of Appeals held that there was the necessary substantial relationship between the bank's activity, meaning the use of the correspondent bank, and the claim asserted to meet the statutory requirements was it has to arise from. And the Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit then concluded that, yes, due process was satisfied. There was both the sufficient contacts, the necessary relationship, and the U.S. Interest in preventing the U.S. banking system becoming an instrument in support of terrorism. And in a post-Daimler era, there are federal court decisions by a district court in a case called Strauss versus Credit Lyonnais and Weiss versus National Westminster Bank, which again permitted the assertion of specific jurisdiction against two foreign banks in actions brought under the Anti-Terrorism Act by U.S. citizens and estates who were victims, again, of terrorist attacks in Israel and Palestine, allegedly perpetrated by Hamas. The claims against the bank, again, were based on their use of their New York branch as the exclusive clearing channel for U.S. dollar transfers for customers, including transfers on behalf of the Committee for Palestinian Welfare to various charities that were allegedly fronts for Hamas. Now, the ATA allows you to have nationwide process and have contacts with the United States as a whole. The district court first held that the bank's conduct through their New York branches as clearing channels was sufficient, again, to satisfy this lesser standard of transacting business, and that gives rise to specific jurisdiction. Second, the court said that these wire transfers made to charities funding Hamas established this requisite nexus for specific jurisdiction, both as a statutory and constitutional matter. Now, this case goes further than Leachy because only a small fraction of the transfers at issue were routed through New York, I think five New York transfers of about $205,000. Nonetheless, the district court explained that without this activity, the money would not have been paid to the charities and delivered to Hamas during the time frame of these attacks. So, although Daimler had made clear that the banks in Strauss and Weiss were not subject to general jurisdiction, that is, you can't sue them for unrelated claims, and that these banking activities were not the exception that Daimler had noted, the banks were nonetheless subject to specific jurisdiction, notwithstanding that the harms had occurred outside the United States. So, the use of, if you will, specific jurisdiction to fill in the gaps may be working in this area, at least as far as plaintiffs are concerned. And so a broad use of specific jurisdiction might be able to be used for foreign defendants, against foreign defendants to bring them into the U.S. Jurisdictional reach. Now, there was a case decided Monday. This is the Bristol-Myers Squibb decision. And I think I probably should let Sam talk more of that because I see I have a five-minute sign up as well, and I do want to get to other things. But the Bristol-Myers case did emphasize that you had to have a connection and it had to relate to. And whether that's going to have any implication for the banks, I am not sure. Now, the last thing I want to talk about is the impact of Daimler on other types of actions. Remember, Daimler arises with respect to a plenary action, that is, an action in which there are pleadings and discovery and so on. And so the Daimler rule is a rule that is going to protect against forum shopping when all of those things are occurring. But there are other situations in the United States where general jurisdiction has been used to obtain authority over a defendant to recognize or enforce a judgment or award, to obtain information from discovery, in discovery from banks and so on. So the question is Daimler going to apply to that kind of a situation? And to give this to you again in brief, given my time concerns, it does seem to me that, and the Second Circuit has applied the Daimler rule to a case in which they were bringing a suit to recognize and enforce a foreign arbitral award. And I would suggest to you that the kinds of burdens that you see in a recognition action are really quite different on a defendant than in a plenary action. So my own view is that Daimler ought not to apply in that situation, but we'll have to see what the court does with that. Another interesting place is whether it applies in discovery applications and asset discovery proceedings involving non-parties, including foreign banks. If it does, foreign non-parties may not be able to be subpoenaed to provide information in connection with discovery in an Ameris action, or to turn over assets or provide information in post-judgment enforcement proceedings. You might also see this in subpoenas against foreign banks by the government, and in what some of you may know as 1782, discovery actions against foreign defendants. Now, the arguments for the application of the Daimler rule to non-party discovery are different from both the plenary merit situation and the recognition and enforcement. Asset discovery and subpoena cases involve foreign non-parties, usually banks, and they're merely called upon to offer up documents or assets rather than to litigate a plenary claim. And thus, again, the due process protections of Daimler would be arguably unnecessary given the more limited burdens. On the other hand, these non-parties have been hailed into a foreign court, required to obtain counsel to represent their interests, and risk the imposition of a judgment or sanctions if they fail to comply. So foreign parties from whom information is sought may also be faced with restrictions on disclosure laws coming out of their own countries. So because plaintiffs are not just seeking discovery but also pursuing citation proceedings, the burdens could be said to be very similar to those in a plenary action. And again, non-parties, unlike defendants, are not accused of violating plaintiffs' rights and have no dog in the fight. And again, in those situations, alternatives such as the Hague Evidence Convention are available. So it's these latter considerations, I think, that have led courts to apply the Daimler rule to these kinds of discovery suits. One case is Gucci versus Lee, in which the court said the Daimler rule is going to apply here. This was, again, an attempt to get asset information after a judgment. And although they said Daimler will apply, no general jurisdiction, they also said, we think we have specific jurisdiction. We're asking for assets, and these defendants in New York can obtain information worldwide. So it's a very odd use of the concept of specific jurisdiction. And again, I have to say, we're in flux. We're going to have to see what the courts will do with this. There is a second case called Leibovitz versus Islamic Republic, which again, the court said was a default judgment against Iran in a terrorist case, and they sought to discover the existence of Iranian assets from two foreign banks with branches in Chicago. But because neither the Japanese nor the French bank were incorporated in the United States, they were, again, not subject to general jurisdiction, nor was designating a registered agent, which both banks did, sufficient because they have to be related. Now, the banks agreed to provide information with respect to their 17 branches in the United States, but there were no Iranian assets there. And the plaintiffs argued that first of all, they said, we don't need jurisdiction to get assets. And the Seventh Circuit said, that argument has never been accepted. Nonetheless, the plaintiffs then went on to say, well, this will give us a specific jurisdiction. And the Seventh Circuit responded that since the Chicago branches were neither holding the Iranian assets, nor did they have access to a centralized database, there was not sufficient relatedness for the purposes of specific jurisdiction. So what I have given you is probably no clear lines, but a set of issues that are going to make judicial jurisdiction in the United States an interesting place to spend your time and attention. Thank you very much.